The U.S. has had its share of foreign entanglements over the past two decades, but even when we haven't sent troops into places like Darfur and Kosovo, we've had military intelligence on the ground to monitor the situation. People like Ron Capps. He spent over a decade bouncing in and out of war-torn countries as a decorated military intelligence officer and a highly regarded U.S. diplomat, but those years spent witnessing bloodshed and brutality had a powerful effect on Mr. Capps, as he recounts in his new book, Seriously Not All Right, Five Wars in 10 Years. It's published by Schaffner Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
You begin your book with you in Congo, holding a gun, ready to commit suicide. Is this book an attempt to explain how you got to that point?
Part of the book is, yes. The book's really two stories. It's the story that gets me to the point where I'm out in the middle of the desert in Darfur, actually, with a pistol ready to end my life, and then the story of what happens afterwards, how I found a road home.
And who and what saved you?
I was in Darfur. I was on my second tour there. I had decided that it was just time for me to end my life. I grabbed a pistol and a couple of bottles of beer, drove out, and the phone rang. And it was my wife calling from Washington, and I looked down at the phone on the seat, figured out that it was her, and that pulled me back from the brink.
Have you had any to fight off any suicidal impulses since?
Not recently, but it's been a long road back.
But other people witnessed what went on in Darfur. I'm not comparing you to Mia Farrow, who has been on the show a number of times when she was an advocate for people getting more involved with what was going on there. She described terrible things in the camps and in Darfur itself. But do you think that you were seeing things that other people weren't seeing?
No, I think that anyone who's been in Darfur for any period of time has seen a lot of the same things that I saw. I think what happened to me is that it was a matter of how long I saw the things in Darfur. I was there for 2 years, but that was the fifth of five wars that I went to, from Rwanda to Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, and then to Darfur.
So just one thing on top of the other.
Very much so.
How had you wound up in the situation in the first place?
I started off as a soldier and was sent over a period of time, served in Afghanistan and Iraq as a soldier.
Which has led many people to have PTSD on their
absolutely.
Own right. But you're an intelligence, weren't you?
I was a military intelligence officer. I started off as a regular Army officer and spent about 9 years doing that. And then in 1994, left the regular Army to join the State Department. I became a Foreign Service political officer, stayed in the Army Reserve. As a Foreign Service officer, I was in Central Africa during the Banyamulenge War, then went back to the Army for a while, and then went to Kosovo as a Foreign Service officer, and then the Army with Afghanistan with the Army, Iraq with the State Department, Darfur with the Army, and then Darfur again with the State Department.
Is that something that happens often? Are you a unique case? Back and forth like that?
I don't think completely unique, but it's not something that happens to a lot of individuals, no.
But I assume also that your experience in one would have help you do the other job better, or at least give you some insights that you might not have had otherwise.
Oh, I think so. You know, coming to the State Department from the Army, I spoke military. I spoke the military language. So when I arrived in Kosovo, I was on a team that was half military and half foreign service, so I was able to work equally as well on both sides of that equation.
Well, can you explain the role of a foreign service officer of the sort that you were?
Sure. I think that a lot of people have this idea of the foreign service that I think Henry Kissinger described political officers as striped pants cookie pushers. And that might have been true in the 1950s, but I think that—
Or CIA agents in disguise.
Well, there may be a few of those. I don't think I'm supposed to say if there are or not. But
Well, you don't have to name names.
That's right. Of course not. My job in Kosovo was to be a member of a very small team of U.S. military and U.S. Foreign Service officers, and we drove around the country trying to get the Kosovars and the Serbs to stop killing each other. We were diplomatic observers. In Iraq, I was a part of a team that was interviewing members of a foreign terrorist organization. In Darfur, I was part of the United States team that was part of the African Union's peacekeeping mission there. So these are not what I think most people think of when they think of the Foreign Service.
Well, how do you go about getting the Kosovars and the Serbs to not kill each other? We're talking about people with a long history, and the Kosovars are really, they're Muslims, aren't they? Mostly kind of Albanians, whereas the Serbs are Eastern Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, and they have ruled Kosovo for a long time, ever since some famous battle in the 14th century.
One of the great questions in working in the Balkans is that about every question it begins with, in 1389, this was
right.
My land, and so everyone has a claim to every piece of land. But to answer your question, the way you get people to stop fighting is to earn their trust. And so on the ground, we would try to earn the trust of the Kosovar Liberation Army rebels and of the Serbian military. Some of that happens at a very high level between people like Milosevic and, you know, the senior Americans on the ground. And some of that happens at the ground level with my team.
Well, there's also was a fair amount of ethnic cleansing going on both sides.
Yeah, there absolutely was.
And so you're also dealing with people who have lost their homes or have been forced out of the area that they've lived in all their lives. I could see where it would be kind of hard to say to them, okay, well, why can't we all be friends?
That specific approach didn't work very well, but, you know, you have to try everything. One of the things that we learned is that no matter how hard you work or no matter how much you can offer, if people aren't tired of killing each other, they're not going to stop.
Now, did you learn, would it be Serbo-Croatian or what would be the language in Kosovo?
I didn't learn either of the languages, but yes, Serbian or Albanian were the two operative languages. We worked with translators, and in my case, I had a translator who spoke both languages and English as well.
And then you have to get up to speed on the politics, the history, and the culture of these places.
Yes. I spent a great amount of time at the early in my early days reading histories, reading books about the politics there. I mean, to be quite honest with you, when I got the call to go to Kosovo, I didn't know where it was. I didn't know what Kosovo was. And the same with Darfur. I'd never heard of Darfur.
So you weren't really prepared when you first showed up. You had to learn on the fly.
You do learn on the fly in these jobs, very, very much so. I read a number of modern and then also some older histories about the areas, just trying to learn the culture, trying to learn how the societies worked, what the grievances might be that I was trying to get people to back away from.
And what could you try? Well, first of all, you had a team, didn't you? I'm assuming they all had their own areas of expertise.
Our team in Kosovo was made up of 6 military officers and 6 foreign service officers. We started off with we had the desk officer from Kuwait, the Kuwait desk officer from the State Department. We had an intern from Ambassador Gelbard's office. We had a guy who was a communications technician from one of the embassies in the embassy in Germany, and me, and then a couple of other people. We had army officers from all over, but. That's the ad hoc nature of this is that you get who's available.
And I've spoken to a number of people over the years from the military who said that they were not trained to help somebody find a refrigerator or do the kinds of things that they suddenly found themselves doing. And some of them resented it or just felt that that's not why they went into the military.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. A lot of military officers find themselves, particularly in these last couple of wars that we've fought, doing work that they think the Agency for International Development should be doing or some non-governmental organization should be doing. And they're very surprised when that's what they're tasked with. And many of them do not feel competent. I spoke with the defense attaché in the Republic of Chad, and she said that exact thing to me. She said, "Why am I the one who is doing development work here?"
My guest is Ron Capps, C-A-P-P-S. His memoir, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. It is published by Schaffner Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You frequently mention being called to inspect dead bodies, many that have been thrown into ditches. What were the circumstances of those deaths?
Well, that would have happened in a number of the countries where I worked. In one particular case, we were in Kosovo. The Serbian military police were going into a village called Racak, and it was January. We, as military observers or diplomatic observers, wanted to go into the village to stop the fighting, to find out what was going on, and we were kept out of the village. While we were being kept out of the village, 45 men were brutally murdered. Some were beheaded. Many were shot in the back of the head and left to die in a ditch.
By which side?
The Serbian military police committed that atrocity particularly. And we had to go in the next morning when we were actually allowed to go back in.
Now, were you there when Milosevic stepped down, or how do we describe what happened?
I was not. That happened a couple years later. I was there.
And did things really change, or haven't they remained troubled to some degree?
I think there's still some problems in the Balkans. It's not Switzerland, as we used to say. But Kosovo is now an independent nation, and I'm still in touch with some of my Kosovar teammates, and I know that friends of mine who were foreign service officers go back and teach there at the university.
How did what you experienced there affect you?
I think that was the war that changed my life more than any other experience that I had. There's a quote I use as the epigram for that section, and it says that you can only love one war. After that, I suppose you do your duty. And it's attributed to, I've never been able to track it down, but it's attributed to the great war correspondent Martha Gellhorn. And I think that war changed me more than any other because I was so close to it. I was tasked to go there and stop the fighting. And I spent 2 years trying to do so. And the fighting was still going on for the first year. And then we spent another year trying to clean up afterwards.
Well, before that, you were in Uganda in 1995. That was when Congo was still called Zaire, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. I was sent there by the Department of Defense to augment the Defense Attaché Office in Kampala, Uganda. The Banyamulenge War was going on just across the border in Zaire, and that was just a follow-on from the Rwandan genocide.
And were you there when the genocide occurred?
I was not. When the genocide happened in 1994, I was in Washington. I had just joined the Foreign Service, and I was still in training at that time.
But the politics there are so murky, it's really hard to know why one country is doing what it's doing. Uganda has been involved in Rwandan politics. Congo has been involved in Rwandan politics. Rwanda has been involved in Congolese politics.
Yeah, it's a very, very complex place. I spent a number of years working there. I think it's important to remember that the senior leaders of Rwanda grew up in Uganda because they were driven out in the late 1950s as a result of it's referred to as the small genocide. There were only a couple of 100,000 people killed. But those
unlike
people,
this one,
unlike
which is 800,000
people. Which was 800,000 in 1994. But most of the Rwandan leadership grew up in refugee camps in Uganda, and many of them trained as a part of Yoweri Museveni's military. President Kagame was Museveni's chief of intelligence. And so the relations are long. The relations are very strong.
Well, what was what do people think of the United States? After all, the U.S. did not do anything to stop the genocide. Bill Clinton apologized on the tarmac of the airport in Kigali after the killing stopped, but for not doing anything. But pretty much Rwanda was left alone, and the killing lasted for 100 days.
Yeah, and it's one of the most efficient killings in history. 800,000 people killed, mostly with machetes, in a period of 100 days. President Clinton did go back and apologize for American inaction. And when I was leaving Darfur in 2006, I wrote a cable back to Washington referencing that. I called the cable Darfur, Who Will Apologize? And suggested that if we didn't change our policies, some American president would be the one to apologize to the people of Darfur.
Well, Americans are viewed differently in different countries. I just saw a documentary about Uganda where Americans seem to be really have a major influence, especially Christian evangelicals, on the politics of the country. In other countries, America is the great enemy. Do you have to kind of be aware of that when you work in the Foreign Service?
I think you absolutely have to be aware of how you as an individual and how Americans are viewed. Someone asked me the other day, how do you get people to stop fighting? And I was talking about trust. And they said, well, how do you get them to even let you talk to them? And I said that most rebel commanders have at least some hope that the United States will come, the cavalry will come over the hill. And I spent a lot of time in Darfur explaining to the Darfur rebel leaders there that the cavalry wasn't coming. And that allowed me to at least get in the door and talk to them and then report back on what I learned.
Well, right now, South Sudan, not Darfur, but the neighbor, continues to be a troubled area. Do you think that it's just endemic to that area because of the various groups that are vying for power?
Endemic is a really tough word. I think that in Darfur, I think that in South Sudan, a lot of the wars that we're seeing are simply due to a long history of the inequitable distribution of resources. People see one group getting ahead and feel that their group is being held back, and that if we can, the international community, if we can help governments overcome that sense of inequity, that sense of injustice, then we can start to move towards justice.
It's not just religion. It isn't just Christians and Muslims, but also, if I remember in Darfur, it was also about farmers and nomadic cattle herders.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to think back to Rodgers and Hammerstein in Oklahoma. The farmer and the cowman should be friends, and they're usually not. And there's so much going on in Darfur. It's been characterized as this sort of black and white, you know, it's African versus Arab, or it's Muslim on Muslim, or it's everything. It's very much an inequitable distribution of resources across different ethnic groups.
But you mentioned that the fighting in Afghanistan was different than in other countries. In what way?
Well, in Afghanistan, the control of the nation is very tenuous. The government in Kabul has a very, very light control over the entire nation. I was there 11 and 12 years ago. So things have changed since, but we used to refer to the president of Afghanistan as the mayor of Kabul. That's about all he really controlled, and then parts of his own ethnic group. And control of the nation, control of the countryside is really sort of ridgeline to ridgeline. If you want to walk across the country, as Rory Stewart did, you get to the top of the ridgeline, you have to renegotiate the contract. And so that makes for a very, very different type of fighting and a different type of war.
And what were you doing there?
I was in the regular army again. I'd been called back to active duty, and I was the director of human intelligence operations for all U.S. forces in Afghanistan.
My guest is Ron Capps. His memoir, Seriously Not All Right, Five Wars in 10 Years, published by Schaffner Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ron Capps. His memoir, Seriously Not All Right, Five Wars in 10 Years, published by Schaffner Press. When did you start having nightmares? Was there a specific trigger?
You know, I'm not sure that there was a specific trigger. I think that it's been a cumulative effect for me, the effect of going to so many wars for so many years. I really started struggling while I was in Afghanistan. I'd been there for just a few months and realized that I was having these really awful, terrible nightmares that were keeping me awake at night. And when they started to, when those intrusive images started to creep into my daily life, when I couldn't get my work done, that's when I knew I needed to get help.
Were you experiencing anxiety?
You know, the anxiety came later. I started having anxiety attacks a couple of years after Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, it was intrusive images for me. I could not keep these pictures of the dead out of my head, these really violent, brutal images.
But you'd seen the dead elsewhere, or did that? I can't remember where Kosovo was in relation to this. 45 bodies in a ditch, many of them beheaded. That had to be pretty horrifying.
Yeah. The images that were coming into my head in Afghanistan were those from Kosovo and from Central Africa. I really could not keep those stories, those images out of my head. And that's when I started asking for help.
So you reached out for medical help. How much were you willing to reveal? It's always we hear again and again about how people in the military, especially Marines, don't want to admit that they have PTSD because that would make them look less manly.
That's exactly right. The decision for me to get help was one of I could continue to try and hide my symptoms, but by doing that, I was putting the soldiers that I was sent to Afghanistan to lead at great risk. Or I could go get help, and if I admitted to my senior leadership that I was getting help, and if that help required me to take certain types of medication, I might lose my security clearance and then my job. I couldn't put my job ahead of my soldiers, so I asked for help.
And what did they prescribe?
We started with some talk therapy and Prozac. I went with Prozac America.
Prozac always works when you have PTSD.
It seemed to work for me.
Oh, it did.
It was really important. I started – that was the beginning of my comeback. I was – my psychiatrist there in Afghanistan made an agreement with me that he would not put – the fact that I was in treatment into my permanent records, so to speak, into my medical records, as long as I stayed in treatment and as long as I showed improvement.
Because if you if anybody thought you had PTSD, that immediately would have ended your career?
It might have. It's not clear. There is some leeway in the decision. But one of the things that was made it more difficult was I was in an airborne unit filled with paratroopers and rangers, and for me to step forward and say to my bosses, and actually to say to the guys that worked for me, look, I'm struggling with PTSD. I was really, really afraid that I'd be mocked, I'd be ridiculed, I'd be called weak.
And but were you even thinking that you had PTSD, or were you putting another label on it at the time?
I was pretty sure that this was PTSD. When I left Kosovo, I went back to Central Africa. I was actually the political chief at the embassy in Rwanda. And I knew that I was changed. So I went to see one of the doctors and I said, look, here's what's happening with me. My emotions are very, very close to the skin. I wasn't yet having intrusive images. I wasn't having the anxiety attacks. But the doctor told me, you know, you might have some low level of PTSD, watch what happens, and if it gets worse, let us know. When I got to Afghanistan, it got a lot worse, and it got a lot worse real fast.
And then you went to Iraq. That's out of the frying pan and into the fire. Or is Iraq not worse than Afghanistan?
For me, they were about the same. There wasn't a lot of difference in what I was doing. There wasn't a lot of difference in my personal lifestyle. And in the units that I was assigned to. I went because when I came back from Afghanistan, I went back to my civilian job at the State Department, and they stuck me in this tiny little office actually managing correspondence between the Secretary of State and the ambassador in Paris. That was my first task.
But wasn't that okay for somebody who was fighting PTSD?
I don't think it was because there was no reduction. There was no reentry program. It was sort of, you know, one day you're in the village fighting, and that's on Monday, and by Friday you're at the village inn having a pizza, and there's no reentry program. I wasn't allowed to decompress. I was just put into this very, very different type of scenario, and I didn't adjust well.
So, did you request to go to Iraq?
I was asked to go. Some people that knew me from my Afghanistan experience stopped by my office one day and said, hey, we're putting a team together to go and debrief this foreign terrorist organization. We think you'd be helpful. Will you come with us? And I said, yes, I would.
How did your family react to that decision?
Were
they aware of just how troubled you were at this time?
I think my wife was. I know my wife was. My mom wasn't. My sister wasn't. My wife, I think, took it pretty well. My mom went on Prozac. She needed to be a little more in control of her emotions, I think, because I was in Iraq and the news coming out of Iraq at that time was very bad.
This is after the victory had been declared in Iraq. Now it was becoming obvious that this was going to be a long slog.
Absolutely, this was after the mission accomplished scene. This was after the Abu Ghraib incident, so things were very ugly, particularly in the area where I was in the Sunni Triangle.
And how were you treated as an American? Were you regarded with suspicion?
Were you
in danger?
If you're in a war zone, you're in danger. We were on a small camp out towards the Iranian border. We were not involved in direct combat. We were an intelligence unit working on coming to understand and debrief this foreign terrorist organization. We had military police acting as our security, and then there was an infantry brigade around us. But you know, there was some mortaring and some rockets going around.
And there's always the possibility that the vehicle you're in will hit an IED or some sniper will just happen to be on a rooftop as you drive by. Do you have to be in combat to have PTSD? Isn't just the fear that of the unknown in situations like this, that you might be killed at any given time, enough of a reason to cause people to have PTSD?
I think it is. One of the questions that service members are asked when they have left service and they've gone, say, to the Department of Veterans Affairs for medical treatment is, were you in this combat zone and did you feel that you were under threat? And that question, responding in the affirmative, is considered enough that you then can be tested for PTSD.
Well, you were under threat in pretty much every place that you served, weren't you?
Yes.
My guess is Ron Capps, his memoir, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years. Did you achieve any of what you'd been sent out to Iraq to do?
I think in Iraq we did. Our job was simply to come to understand who the members of this organization were and what their objectives were post-Saddam. We did that in a period of months and then spent some time collating that information to send back to Washington.
And then from this you went to Darfur.
And from that I went to Darfur.
Which is where you thought of killing yourself.
Right. I'd been in Darfur for 20 months when that happened, 22 months actually.
Do you think the United States made a mistake by not getting more involved?
I wrote a cable back to Washington saying that I did at the time. I think that we had an opportunity to stop a genocide. We had 2 presidents and 3 secretaries of state call that genocide, and yet we did not take what was, in my view, sufficient military action to stop it.
Of course, there was always the fear of we were already in bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq. The last thing any president wanted to do was to send even the smallest military force to another place.
Oh,
get
absolutely.
The United States involved in a third war.
That's right, and that's why I spent a lot of time telling the Darfurian rebels the cavalry isn't coming. But that didn't change the fact that this is what I thought was the right thing to do, and that's why I wrote the cable back to Washington.
Has Darfur has the problem there been resolved?
No.
It's still part of Sudan, isn't it?
It is still part of Sudan. The rebels' goals was never to separate from Sudan. Their goals were very much just to have an equitable distribution of resources.
And to stop being killed by these marauding horsemen who came into their area.
And who worked for the government of Sudan.
Your mother passed away when you were there?
She did.
That must have added to your depression.
I think it did. I was about 9 months into my first year there, and my wife called and said, hey, your mom's really sick. You should come home. I spent about a month sitting by her bedside as she was dying, and then not long after that, I went back to Darfur.
So, you know, part of the problem, as far as I see it, is that your lifeline was just very stretched. Perhaps if you'd had more family or more contact with family and other things, that could have kept you on an evener keel. You write about moral injuries.
I absolutely agree. If I had taken better care of myself, I might not have driven out into the desert that day. If I had spent more time at home in between these five tours. I think that a moral injury is something that we are just starting to learn about. Some psychiatrists up at the Boston VA hospital and some of their researchers have come up with this idea, and it came out with Jonathan Shea and Brett Litz from Boston VA. And the whole idea is that a moral injury is when someone takes part in or fails to prevent or even in some cases witnessing it, some action that violates a deeply held moral belief. And I think Jonathan Shea wrote about this because of his treatment of Vietnam veterans coming home from the war. And he worked with them for 30 years, and he found that this was something that so many of them really, really struggled with.
Did you have to deal with the press when you were doing this job?
I did. There were a couple of times when that was my job, was to be the press attaché.
Well, you had to lie to the press, I suspect, more than once. Well, do you think the press has done a good job in covering these various conflicts?
I did my best to never lie to the press. There was one time when I took the press on a bit of a wild goose chase to keep them out of a certain area. But as a press attaché, I don't think I ever consciously told a lie to the press. And there were a couple of reasons for that. One, we worked together. We might have had different readerships, but in many cases, I would be on the ground alongside journalists, and we were going to places at about the same time, and I was trying to cover what had happened for my readership in Washington while they were trying to cover for theirs. And so we worked side by side in many cases.
How long do you think you had PTSD before you retired?
I started noticing very, very light symptoms after Kosovo, so that would have been about 2000, and I retired in the end of 2008, so I probably had
a long time.
I did.
And do you think that, I mean, was the PTSD the reason you decided to retire?
No. I retired because I lost my security clearance, and the investigation of that would have taken, you know, some incredibly long period of time. I wasn't willing to sit around Washington waiting for that to happen.
Why did you lose your security clearance?
I lost my security clearance was suspended because I actually used an unapproved device to transfer information from an unclassified system to a classified system, the same way that I'd done overseas hundreds and hundreds of times. But by doing it in Washington, I'd broken a rule that the diplomatic security agents weren't prepared to have broken. And despite the fact that I'd never had, in 25 years, I'd never had so much as a security infraction on my record, a very low-level infraction. I'd never had anything. As soon as I did this, my security clearance was taken away from me.
So you must be a little upset by the way this was handled by the State Department.
I certainly was at the time. Certainly was at the time.
We have very little time, but you now work with military veterans through an organization called Veterans Writing Project. Do you think writing is an important way to get past these problems?
Yes, absolutely I do. Writing was how I found the road home. When therapy wasn't working for me, when medication wasn't working, writing these stories over and over again until I got control of them was how I found my way home. I've got a little sign in my office that says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And writing is how I got control of these memories.
Ron Capps will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Half King. That's at 505 West 23rd Street. His book, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years, published by Schaffner Press. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.